Thank you very much for being here in what will be probably be the most boring session of Linux Tag ever. The point of my presentation is actually to try to provide some sort of overview of what has been the most recent research on the idea of sustainability of open source software, both as part of several commercial companies and by part of the European research. It's very strange to talk about sustainability of open source here at Linux Tag, since as you have probably seen down the hall, there are lots of companies that are perfectly sustainable with open source as well. But the interesting thing is that there is a lot of people that actually does not believe that open source can be sustainable at all. This comes, for example, is one of the many research articles that appeared in places like Harvard Publishing and those publication that goes to the MBA people, that basically says that open source is unable to generate profit, income, jobs, or taxes. And the author stopped just here, short of declaring that open source was the reason behind war, hunger, and destruction. The other aspect is related to the fact that it is very difficult for someone that wants to start an open source company to find exactly how to do it. That's because you get lots of books and lots of research on how to create a perfect service company, how to create a perfect industry, but there is actually very little about something like open source business. And this is strange, especially considering that open source actually has something like 25% of the market of software and services. 25% of the market means that one quarter of all the euros that get spent in software, IT, and services goes to open source software, which is quite a high amount of money. And the obvious question is, okay, if there is such a huge amount of money, first of all, how there are so few open source companies in the world? And the second point is, why don't we see lots of Porsche and Mercedes out of here, of the place? The point is that when we talk about the market, we usually think about a market that is called shrink wrap. That is software that is designed to be sold as is. It's an industrial product. It's usually sold in boxes, in CD, as downloads, and so on, with the basic idea that software that is sold is the same for you and the person that is sitting next to you. So it's an industrial product that is sold as is. This is actually a very small part of the market. For example, for Europe, it's 19% of the market. For the US is even lower, 16%. The vast majority of the money in software and services is actually in software that is developed on contract and in software that is developed inside of companies. Both of these, for example, for Europe is 52% and 29% is slightly higher the internal development for US companies because they tend to have slightly larger IT department groups. But the basic idea is that when we talk about the market, we have to look at the entire market. It's like something from IDC that recently I saw that say that Linux has something like 5% of all the server market because they counted only server that got sold with a commercial Linux installed over. But that is not a very accurate way of measuring things, of course. And the same thing happens here. So you can get a very large software company that claims, oh, we own the market for software development, while in the reality, they own the market that is shrink-wrapped. That is, they own a very small piece of the pie. In 2005, Rishabh Ghosh and lots of his colleagues at the University of Maastricht, under a contract with the European Commission, performed a study on the impact of open source inside of the European community and found that basically companies that are using and contributing to open source employed something like 500,000 people, which is a lot of people, and it is something that usually you don't get mentioned very soon, very commonly in magazines and things like that. You only see the fact that the largest software house are all proprietary software house. And that's because they are all proprietary software house that sold shrink wrap market. When we talk about the software market at large, that is the 52% and 29%, when you look at studies about that market, you will find that open source has a very high percentage there. That is something like 85% of the software that is developed internally has a substantial, that is from 33% to up 80, 90% of software is open source. So open source there has such a high percentage that actually it's impossible to imagine internally developed software without open source. So, for this reason, the European Commission was so interested in studying if this can be turned into some, let's say, sort of analysis, if this value can be converted into a sustainable business model. Because, as you probably know, there is only one software, European software company in the top 100, which is SAP. And basically, all the software companies in the world are from the US or Japan. And this means that Europe is seriously lagging behind. So they funded a set of projects designed to find a way to increase this kind of use of open source in commercial environment. And one of these studies was Flossmetrics, which just ended. And it was designed to try to find a set of building blocks. That is, if you have a business model, this business model can be decomposed in a set of building blocks that put together create the business model that your company may use. We have done some sort of survey that covered a little bit more than 280 companies, and we analyzed the business model of each of these companies, and we applied a method that is called business decomposition to find 10 pieces that we found can be used to explain all the 280 different business models. The first one is one that is very common. It's called dual licensing, and it's the model that is adopted when you have one source code tree that is released at the same time with two different licenses, which seems a little bit strange because usually you get a product and one license. But an interesting point is that when you are the owner of the rights to this source code, you can license it as many times you want, in any way you want. So the point is, let's imagine that you have this source code product. You license it at the same time with two separate licenses. One is a strong copyleft license, like the GPL or the AGPL, and the other one is a pure proprietary license. You can use the license that is compatible with the use that you want to do. So, if you want to use a product like this, the most famous example is MySQL. If you want to use MySQL inside of one of your products, and your product is compatible with the GPL, you can use the free license. And basically, you have to pay nothing to anyone. If you have a product that is proprietary, and you don't want actually to turn it into a GPL product, you have to pay for the proprietary license. So you're basically paying for an exception to the GPL. This is absolutely legal. Actually, it's something that is considered even appropriate. There is a very big advantage of this model and a very big disadvantage of this model. The advantage is that what is called the sale condition, that is the reason why someone has to give you money, is very clear and is very easy to verify compliance with it. That is, if your product is open source, you don't have to pay anyone anything anywhere. If your product is proprietary, then you have to pay. So it's very simple and clear. There is a very huge disadvantage that was discovered only later by adopters of this model. The problem is that this model basically does not allow contribution from the outside, because since your business model is based on the idea of selling exceptions to the GPL, you must have the property of every piece of code that is inside of your source code tree. Because for each piece of code, you need to have the rights to give this kind of exception to your commercial customers. So this means that if someone from the outside uses the GPL version and contributes you back something under the GPL, basically you are not allowed to put it back in your tree. you have to make the user, the contributor, sign a long and wordy legal document that say that basically you relinquish all rights to your code, and you give the company that sells the product the right to relicense it with proprietary components and so on. And this is a very significant barrier, not only from a psychological point of view, but basically blocks any commercial contributions there. In fact, recently, some of the people from MySQL observed that basically 99% of the source code inside of MySQL came only from MySQL employees. And that's why you have lots of forks of MySQL. That is, people that took the GPL version, because that is one of the right to take only one of the license, and start enhancing and modifying that version that is now competing with the other version. A slight variation on this model is called the open core model, which is quite famous because lots of what are called enterprise open source companies are adopting this kind of model. It's a variation of the dual license because you have two separate code trees. One is the code tree for what is called the community edition, and one is the enterprise edition. That differs basically from the fact because the community edition works more or less, does have some functionality, but if you want really stability, if you want all the enterprise features and so on, you have to pay for the proprietary version. This is actually a variation on the first one, because if we go and analyze it, we see that inside of an open core model, you get lots of pieces that are open source. Take, for example, a group or a system called Zimbra. It does integrate something like 35 different open source components, and the product itself is a wrapper around them. It's code that ties together all these kind of things and provide a nice interface, configuration, management, and so on. But basically, it's a wrapper around products made by others. And to be able to create a proprietary version, you still have to dual license this wrapper. So the result is the same. You have two products. It's also very easy to identify which version should be, let's say, bought by a company that wants to use the feature, because if the feature are available in one version and on the other, so the sale condition is also very clear. But the problem is exactly like for dual licensing. Open core has very, very little contributions from the outside. It does have also the same problem of dual license, that you create your own competitors. I will make a very small example. I had a customer that has the need for creating a very large mail system for something like 20,000 people. They could have gone to an enterprise open source company and say, we want 20,000 licenses for your enterprise product. And they saw the cost and say, oh, for that amount of money, we can simply pay to add these features to the open source edition. And in fact, that's the thing that they did. They ended up paying something 30 to 40,000 euros for adding the missing features to the open source edition, and they're happily using that without contributing back to the proprietary version. This is one of the biggest problems of open core systems. You create, if the product works well, you're creating your own competition. And if you are very, let's say, strict and say, no, the open source edition will not receive any additional features, is left behind, is unstable, and so on, people will not use it. So you lose also the marketing advantage. It's a very thin rope you walk when you use an open core model. And in fact, lots of companies that started with open core moved a little bit to other models while retaining some aspects of open core, but moving to more, let's say, alternative models, because there is always this risk that your product will become your own competitor. Then you have what is considered to be the pure model of open source, the product specialist. You know a software product very well. You know it perfectly. You lived by coding it and so on. And so if someone wants something around that product, services, customization, extensions, and so on, they will simply come to you. This is considered to be a pure model because there are no additional constraints on the source code. There are no separate licenses. The open source and the enterprise edition are the same. So basically, it's a model that is pure in its sense. It does have a huge advantage that this model allows contribution from outside, because you don't have barriers for contribution, you don't have to make people sign anything. And most of the project that we'll see later receives substantial contribution from the outside. The negative point of this model is that also the barrier for competition is very low, because anyone can take your software product, study it, research it, document it, and start selling your own services. So you can see there is a trade-off. If you put a barrier for competition, you put a barrier to contribution from the outside as well. If you don't have a barrier, you accept contribution from the outside, but you also, that is, lower the barrier for your potential competitors. Then there is a peculiar model, which is called the platform provider. The platform provider does not make much code, but basically engineers a product. The most famous example is Red Hat, and I'm not saying that Red Hat has not contributed lots of source code and lots of things to the open source, to the various open source communities. But if you look at all the source code inside of Red Hat Enterprise Linux, for example, you will see that the code that was directly manipulated by Red Hat is less than 5%. 95% of the code comes from many projects, hundreds of projects, that Red Hat puts together and engineer a product around them. And what the product is actually not the software product that is made by running Enterprise Linux, but is actually an ecosystem. Because if you want to, let's say, deliver a proprietary software package and you want to run it on Linux, you have to choose a platform to run it on. So the value of this ecosystem is the fact that lots of people knows and runs Red Hat or its compatible clones, like CentOS, Scientific Linux, Oracle Linux, and so on. And so the real value that Red Hat obtains comes from what is called a multilateral market. Red Hat is interesting because lots of software runs on Red Hat, and lots of people is trained on Red Hat because there are lots of Red Hat systems around. So when a company wants to install a new Linux system, they have to decide which platform they will have to use. And usually, they will go to the platform that has the largest market share. So it's a positive, let's say, feedback circle. And its value is so high that Red Hat is very happy, actually, to have competitors that are using their own code to create compatible platforms. Basically, what you have to do is simply to take the source code, remove the trademark, like the hat, you have to change the names and so on, and you get a compatible product. And Red Hat is happy, because actually you are enlarging their own platforms. You're increasing value that can be estimated something like $10 for every new installation that you make, be it Red Hat or compatible. When you have a new, let's say, node added to the network, to this network, you are actually adding value to everything else. It's something similar to when the first faxes were introduced. When you have only one fax, there is no value in it, because you have not the opportunity to send faxes anywhere. When you have two, it's slightly more useful. That is, at least you can send fax to one point, but not much more. When everyone has a fax, that's the maximum utility. The same thing applies to platforms, and that's why they are investing so much time in engineering. And that's why they are accepting competitors. Then we begin to enter into what are considered to be the specialized model. The first one is the software selection. Within Flossmetrics, one of the studies that we have done, we have provided some sort of statistical model that allows to us to estimate that there are at least 14,000 stable and mature software packages for enterprise use, enterprise or public administration use. 14,000 stable and mature, not a full project, those that can be used. If you have 14,000, deciding which package to use is a lot of effort. In another project that was done by the European Commission, which was a very large study of the adoption of open source by public administration, it was found out that actually software selection was the single highest cost for a migration. It was much higher than training, for example. And this is because if you don't choose the right software, you incur lots of additional cost for your decision because you have to change it later or you have to pay for adapting it to your needs and so on. So it was something like 20% of the cost of a migration was software selection. It's something that applies especially to large companies or to large public administration because they usually have lots of different, activities running at the same time. So it's some sort of a la carte service. It's also something that is common in the enterprise world because, for example, there are lots of specialist companies that provide support for selecting the best ERP, the best groupware system, and so on. And if you go to things like Gartner or Forrester, they do have this service as well. They call it the Forrester Wave, or they call it the Magic Quadrant that provides you the indication of what are the best software product in the market. But the point is the same. They allow you to select one product over the other. And of course, they avoid the point to having you to install and test all the thing. Then you have the aggregate support providers. Aggregate support providers are companies that concentrate in a single link lots of different support offerings. Let's imagine that you have a very large company. You have hundreds of open source products and you want to have support for all of them. So you're sure that when something goes back in bed, you have someone to kill. At this point, let's imagine that you have, as the average large company has something like 120 different open source projects employed inside of a company. So you go and find out 120 companies that provide support for that specific product. Sometimes, since the company are small, you have to find one for every country you're working in. Aggregate support providers do this kind of thing for you. They have 120 or 200 or 300 different support contracts. They have lots of internal people that is also able to support you, so they will be able to provide a first level of management directly inside the company. And you manage and you do a single contract with them. Of course, you pay for the privilege. But the point is that for a large company, contract negotiation is a very long and difficult process. So just cutting that by one order of magnitude is sufficient to make quite a good margin in living. Then there is one that I call the parasite model, which is legal insurance. I call it parasitic because it does not contribute anything to any project, basically. It's an insurance. Actually, it's not that. It's the composition of two different services. The first one is some sort of legal consulting that tells you your right to use the license of this product in this way or your right to integrate this product there and so on. The second one is a pure insurance. And it exists because, unfortunately, there are some legal conditions that prevents you to be completely sure that you're able to run your software the way you want to. The biggest problem, actually, I would say 95% of the problem is related to software patents. That you may think that does not apply in Europe, but actually that's not true because there are software patents all across Europe, especially. I don't know if you follow the little bit of drama that followed the announcement of the WebM video standard released by Google. They claimed that they had some sort of clearance for, they checked that it does not infringe patents and so on. And actually, probably it's true because we have done some sort of patent analysis on that as well. And it's highly probable that there are no infringed patents in Europe on that. The problem is that no one can be sure. Because you can get from somewhere a small one-person company that say, oh, we developed that and we patented it somewhere in the world, and now you give us $10 trillion for willful infringements and everything else. So basically, you pay insurance. You pay insurance to make sure that nothing bad comes to your company. It's parasitic because, as I said, nothing of this money comes back to the project. There is no value for the open source project at all, not even for the company. There is one that is absolutely easy, training and documentation. Someone has to train people to do this kind of thing. Then you have indirect revenues, which was in the past one of the most common models. for example, used by all hardware companies. You release open source drivers for your hardware because you hope that open source people will use your hardware by using your open source product. So basically, it's an indirect model because the money is not provided directly by the fact that you are selling something, but by the fact that you are enabling business on another side. Another model that is very common is for the Mozilla Foundation. They receive 95% of their money from cashbacks from search engines. Because when you open up Firefox, you get a branded page from Google, and Google pays back for that page. So they get something like 60 or 70, I think, million dollars per year, which is not a bad amount of money. And they use that to improve the browser, so more people will use the browser, so more people will use Firefox, and more people will go to the branded page on Firefox. So they get more money, and Google is happy. Then there is a model that is anomalous. It's anomalous because it's called an economically internal model. This is a model that is not designed to make you money, but to save money from development. It's called research and development sharing, or open inside, as the people from 451 group uses to call it. It's simply the idea that we all share lots of code that needs to be maintained because it's part of our internal infrastructure. I have to do it, you have to do it, everyone has to do it. So, a potential solution to this problem is that we put together all our source codes and we create a single project and we take from that project, so we only have to adapt to it and not redo it from scratch. One of the most famous examples is Eclipse. Eclipse actually, as you probably know, is the result of the open sourcing of a very large code base. It's a part of an acquisition by IBM of a company called Rational. They basically took the integrated development environment and they open sourced it. And instead of saying this is an IBM project and so on, they created a consortia around that and invited lots of people to participate. So the interesting thing is that lots of companies are developing the integrated development environment because everyone that has some sort of modifiable software has an IDE. Nokia does have one, Motorola does have one, SAP does have one, lots of companies. But the point is that this is not differentiating. It's not something, you are not selling SAP because you say, oh, I have the best integrated development environment in the world. It's something that you have to have. It's like plumbing. You need it, but it's not something that differentiates you from someone else. So the interesting point is that one after the other, in various months, lots of companies started scrapping their own internal development environment that was paid with their own money and started adopting Eclipse. Because the cost of adopting Eclipse inside of their company was 1/10 of the cost of developing the integrated development environment on their own. And the nice thing is that every time you have to make some modification, you have to give them back. So it's easier because the next edition of Eclipse will already have it inside. So you reduce maintenance cost. And so it started with Nokia. Nokia started using Eclipse because they wanted to use it for their mobile software development system. And it was exactly the same thing for Motorola that uses the patches from Nokia and extended it a little bit to create their own internal development environment, reducing further the cost because it was not one order of magnitude, but it was two orders of magnitude. And the same thing applies to SAP. They added a business process modeling system to Eclipse that was used by lots of other companies. They are contributing back their own patches. So now, the IBM contribution, originally it was all IBM code, of course, they open sourced it. It was quite a substantial amount of code. Now less than 50% of the code comes from IBM. And lots of code comes from smaller companies. Actually, the vast majority of code comes from individual developers. They are adapting Eclipse for their own projects. This means that overall, you are reducing the cost of doing, let's say, of integrating these components by 50%, because half of the code is managed by others than your company. There is another reason why this model is getting lots of attention, and it's the fact that it is becoming more and more difficult to maintain competition in complex systems. This is a slide from the embedded world, but actually in the server world is absolutely the same. The amount of lines of code per product is increasing at a much higher rate than the number of developers. So you have a gap. Let's see if I manage to see. You have this gap. That is, you have to find a way for making these developers develop all this amount of code. There are two ways. The first one is some magical sort of way to make a developer 10 times more productive. You can give it some pharmaceutical components. You can try to, I don't know, incentive him or something like that. But the point is that, as lots of previous research in software engineering shown, there is no silver bullet. There is no single technology or methodology that will allow such an increase in productivity by developers. So the only alternative is sharing effort. That is, you don't only have your own developers, but you have the developers of the other companies that are working together with you. And in fact, also as part of Lost Metrics, we have done a research and we performed an analysis to see exactly what is the real cost of adopting open source inside of a structured software development practice. Because as you know, it's not just the fact that you take and reuse. You have to adapt, you have to create glue code, you have to change architecture and so on. But basically the result found that when you use open source, you are saving an amount of effort that is proportional to the percentage of open source that you're using inside of your company. And the interesting point is that the staffing has a reduction that is extremely important. It's not proportional to the amount of code, because actually staffing decreases at a lower rate. But if you see, for example, for the first three lines, it's 100,000 lines of code, which is a substantial software package. When you use open source inside of that, you are able to do it in half the time, that is in less than 1 year, and you are able to do it with slightly less than 9 people instead of 20. It means that even a small company can do a very substantial software product. And this is, in fact, was confirmed by a study that was done in 2009 by the Venice University that found that companies that are using open source software are not only more productive, but are able to sell their products to a class of companies that is higher than their own. So, for example, small companies are able to sell product to medium-sized company or even to large companies because they're able to sell larger products and more complex product. Of course, this does not happen overnight. This is a graph of the contribution of WebKit, which is a project that actually was not started by Apple, because it's based on a product by the KDE group. It's called a KHTML. It was re-engineered by Apple and released under the name WebKit. Initially, all the development was done by Apple engineers. But with time, you see that other companies started providing patches and so on. And now, in the end, you see that Google is contributing more people than Apple, more patches, and you have others, with something like 25 different companies that develop especially for the mobile world, and you have Research in Motion, and you have Nokia, and so on. Right now, Apple contributes less than 27% of all the changes to the project. But they are able to use the product, and it is improving much faster than if they had to do it on their own. Of course, it means that this product is available also to its competitors. But a browser nowadays is not a differentiating thing. You have to have it. A browser is necessary for every mobile device, and even basically for every device. And the point is that if everyone has to develop their own browser, you have simply to have a sunk cost that you will never recover. In fact, the only company that is not contributing is a very large company from the US that has a product called Windows. But they do wonderful things, nevertheless. Vista was wonderful, I remember. And so the point is, we have so 10 building blocks. All of them, as you saw, has advantages and disadvantages. There are no perfect business model, And actually, business model change with time and change with the market conditions. So the point is, if you are an open source entrepreneur and you want to start your own company or you want to improve your own company, the first thing is to understand clearly which business you're on. And the second one is understanding how your business works. This is traditionally done in those business schools when you have lots of interesting experiments with people and you go camping together and things like that. But the basic point is that when you understand every aspect of your company, you're able to have a clear image of what is good and what is bad and can be improved. One of the best visual methods is called the business model canvas from a researcher called Osterwalder, which is a very nice experiment. You have basically, you draw a set of boxes on a large whiteboard, and with the post-its, you simply add your ideas about every single part. What are these parts? The first one is customer segment. Who are we selling something to? It may be surprising, but when we have done this experiment many times, especially in the Southeast of Asia, where there are lots of open source companies, 1/3 of the companies, of open source companies, of course, were not very clear about who their customer was. The second point is, what are you selling? What's the value proposition? It's in business speak. That is, if someone gives you money for something, what they are paying for? Those two aspects are the single most important thing of your business model, because everything else can be derived from that. For example, key resources, the things inside of your company that are fundamental to provide your value to your customers. How can you identify those key resources? It's very easy. You take a list of everything that you have in your company. Immaterial and material, trademark, source code, your office, people, cash, everything. And you do what is called the Saint-Exupéry experiment. You start removing one piece at a time and you see if your company still works. For example, offices. You have an office. Can you live without an office? For most companies, probably so. So it's not a key resource. It's something that is nice to have, but it's not fundamental. People, you are developing something. Can you do it without your developers? Probably not. So that's the key resources. It means that needs to be managed and to provide certainty that these key resources will remain with you in time and so on. Then from that, you can derive everything else. Because for example, you have things like revenue stream. They are paying you in some way. How they are paying you? Monthly, once per year, only when they provide you services and so on. And the amount of money can be obtained by an honest and objective evaluation of what value you are providing to your customers. And the important point is that probably your customers are a different willingness to pay depending on who they are. And we will see later how to use it to improve your revenue. The basics, as I said, the basic point are customer segments and value proposition. There are two identifying structures inside of your company. That is, your value proposition is based on two things. The first one is property, something that can be transferred. The other one is efficiency, something that you do well, that cannot be transferred anywhere. Those two things are the defining aspects of every business model that you have in open source software, because property, trademarks, the fact that you have the copyrights of your source code, as we saw in dual license and in open core and so on, and you get the things that are on the left one. Then you have efficiency, the product specialist, the training, the things that you do well, because you are expert in doing it, are on the right, and in the middle you have, let's say, all the mixing things. The interesting point about efficiency is that it does have some properties that are very useful for helping your companies in deciding how to price products. Efficiency is something that, as the basic economic theory says, increases monotonically. The more you work on something, the more you're good at doing something. The first time you install a complex software package, you probably pass 1 week in finding how to make it work. The second time you take 1 day. The third time you take 1 hour. That's efficiency, the ability to perform a fixed amount of work in a prescribed amount of time. Efficiency increases more or less linearly with time, with effort, unless you have a new technology or something that changes. A good example nowadays is virtualization or cloud computing or something like that. It's much easier nowadays to create a new instance of a complex software product by recreating an instance that is already existing. So you're more efficient because there is a new technology. New technology introduces a jump in efficiency. And the other aspect of efficiency is that if you stop practicing, efficiency goes down. So if you say, oh, now I'm the most important expert in the world about Drupal. Now I stop working because now everyone knows that I'm the most important expert in the world. The thing is, your product will continue to improve, but you will not get along with it. So your efficiency will decrease. What does it mean? That it's possible from this to understand why people should pay you. Let's imagine that I am one of your potential customers. I want to ask you to install a complex software system. I can do it on my own. I find an internal people that knows something about IT, and I say, oh, how much time does it need? This amount of time, because it's the first time that I do it. It's 1 month. Then you find some companies around you that has do it 2 or 3 times. Let's say I do it sometimes. So they are more efficient. The amount of effort that they have to expend to do it is lower. This means that this is the margin that they can get. Because if you price your let's say, work higher than this line, the company, your customer will say, no, I will do it myself. It will cost less this way. What happens if you are really, really, really an expert? Then you do it for a living, you're incredibly efficient. This means that your margin will be higher. But you have to take into consideration that actually the margin will be higher, but you will have invested lots of research in it. So you have always, every time you invest something, ideally every month, you should have a balance between the amount of research invested in new technologies, in learning, in knowing, doing things, and the increase in efficiency that you will have. It's a business decision that you do every month, or at least every 6 months. Basically, this is the basis of one of the models that we saw, the product specialist. I'm very good, I'm doing lots of work, so I'm more efficient than you are. It's possible to derive most of the models there using this idea of efficiency. This is a graph that is the standard IT adoption graph, that is how a large company adopts a software product. It basically starts with the idea that, yes, I need a software product, so they go and look for alternatives. They pay someone for installing it, for adapting it, for doing training, for doing maintenance, and then dismissing it. Now, let's look at each one of them, and you will see that here, for example, you have the software software selection specialist, the one that will help you in finding in an efficient way the best product. Then you have installation and integration, and you have the product specialist. Testing, and you have the platform provider. Training, and you have the training provider, and so on. So the basic point is that by using this idea of efficiency and property, you are basically able to explain most of the business model that you have actually in the market right now. And especially, it's possible for you, if you're an entrepreneur, to decide how to change model with time, because it's usually model change every 2 to 4 years. That is, a company never has the same model for more than 4 years. Even Red Hat started selling boxes, physical objects, and t-shirts and other things. An important point is, what's the difference between an open source company and a proprietary one? Basically, you have the access to source code, which gives you 2 advantages. The first one is some sort of free marketing. That is, people will be able to use your product even without paying you. So you will seed the market. This is actually not such a strong difference, because lots of proprietary software companies are doing the same thing. They are releasing free editions of their software to seed the market. And the other aspect is contributions. But as we saw, there is a trade-off, because if you accept contribution from the outside, you are basically you cannot be used models like OpenCore or dual licensing or something like that, because they hamper contributions. So you are lowering the barrier of competition from the outside. So how to improve the efficiency of your company? One of the biggest problems is in the customer segmentation. That is the fact that you are not targeting really the one that will pay you money for your product. There is a very simple graphical model as well, which is called the competition matrix or the segmentation matrix. You basically have a very big whiteboard, and you start thinking about all the possible markets you can be in. For example, imagine that you sell an open source document management system. Who's your customer? If you think that everyone is my customer, you're thinking in the wrong way, because you are not differentiating in any way. Because customers want to be targeted for their own specificity. So if you go to a company, maybe a large or a small one, you can say, oh, this product is the same if you're small, large, medium, if you are working in industry or if you're a public administration. Basically, you are saying that you have no value specific for him. So what you do? You start thinking about, first of all, companies, small, medium, and large. Then you have public administration, that you have local, regional, or central. And you have different segments. For example, in industry, you have production, you have retail, you have services, IT, and so on. In public administration, you have management and administration, you have healthcare, and so on. And for each cell of this matrix, you see if it's possible to imagine a custom version of your product designed for that aspect. This does not mean that you have to make a different version for each customer, but you must highlight the advantages for that specific customer. And the other aspect is that you must find what the competition is, because one thing that you will discover is that competition is different for each cell in this matrix. The last two suggestions. First of all, don't try to push too much your customers to pay you. This is a common mistake. That is what is called the increased monetization rate. That is people that is using the open source edition, for example, in the open core model. People is using the open source edition, and you want to have more of them to pay you for the enterprise edition. One of the most common methods is to cut features from the open source edition and have only in the proprietary one. The only result, after a few years of research in this, is that people will get pissed off and will go to another product. Basically, if your model is based on property, open core, dual license, and so on, the only way to increase monetization is to increase segmentation. That is to create a product that is specific for a market. Because research has found that in that way, you can increase the monetization ratio without pissing off people. On the other hand, for all the models that are based on efficiency, platforming, software specialists, and so on, the best approach is twofold. Increase contributions from the outside, because they will reduce your cost and they will also, let's say, improve the quality of the product itself, and marketing. It may seem strange to think about marketing, but marketing is essential outside of a specific community, because your adopters are actually living in some sort of bubbles. Every community group lives in a group made mainly of peers with the same interest and the same kind of, let's say, approach to the market. So when you're preaching to one of them and say, please spread the word and let everyone knows about this product, you are spreading fast, but only in that specific area. You have to go across bubbles and go towards additional kind of listeners. A common problem is, for example, your product is very famous by IT system administration, but no one in the management and business section knows about it. Because you have to write also marketing brochures, which is one of the most despicable things that I have done in my life. It's terrible to write all those acronym-filled things. Oh, this is a cloud-ready-enabled, flexible, open-source, secure, HIPAA-compliant, and so on. No one actually understands what it means. I don't know, basically, what I wrote down. But the nice thing is that when you put it in front of a manager, you say, oh, it has have HIPAA and clouds and this and that. They basically highlight two or three words and say, this is interesting. Then they go to the IT manager and say, what do you think of this thing? Oh, we are using it since 5 years. And so maybe they will pay you something. The point is, be sure to go over a single, let's say, group of listeners and try to engage with others, even if it's difficult for you. And that's why, in my opinion, one of the most badly done things in lots of open source companies is actually marketing. So, you survived basically 1 hour. Some of you are still alive, which is an interesting thing. Questions, of course.
There's one model which I missed in your list, which is the time-delayed open source release.
Yeah.
One example is Opsy, if you know that. It's a company who have a Windows management software based on Linux servers, and they very strongly promised to release all features into the open source edition after the revenue from the closed source, from the commercial variant, kind of reimbursed the development cost.
Yes.
And it seems to me this is a fairly fair approach, because they say we have to live as a company, but once it paid itself, then we give it to the open source community. And the other thing I wanted to ask is about Canonical. You mentioned two platform providers, and I think that Canonical is trying to go a different way from Novell and Red Hat. Could you maybe shed some light on Canonical with respect to the research you presented here?
Yeah. Well, the first one actually is a very old model. The first one to adopt it was Aladdin with a product called GhostScript. They made a time-delayed version of GhostScript, so you get previous version for as open source and the last one as, let's say, proprietary ones. The point is that for all practical aspects from this kind of analysis is absolutely the same as an open core version. Because the software that you maintain, they are still not released, is for every practical aspect a proprietary one. After some time, you release back as open source, but it's the same thing as an open core model where you move features from one point to the other. This means that, let's say, there are lots of naming variations, but the basic models can be reconducted to this for economic aspect, let's put it this way. As for Canonical, Canonical started with the idea of being a platform, a pure platform, and now is shifting to a more complex mix of models. Because for some aspects, they are service, they are platform specialists, because they provide customization and specific enhancement of Ubuntu to targeted customers. But basically, they are moving to provide services on top of that. Now they are starting selling support and maintenance contracts, for example. They are starting to sell services based on Ubuntu One, which is let's say, an outsourced IT service that provides you synchronization services, music on demand, and things like that. It's adopting a more complex model, because to become a platform provider takes lots of effort and lots of years. I would say that probably it will take something like 5 to 7 years to become a successful platform. And probably Canonical right now would like to increase monetization right now and not 5 years from now. Among this, for example, they started segmenting their market because they offer their platform management system that provides remote management and administration of Ubuntu desktops and servers. That's called Landscape, if I remember correctly. And it's basically a technology designed to help in service maintenance. So they're offering their own product specialist. They are mixing the platform with product specialist and so on. They are moving a lot, I must say. I think that in some way they still have not very clear who they are offering their services to. Because having something like Ubuntu One on an enterprise desktop is a strong negative in my point of view. Lots of companies say, I don't want this kind of thing on my desktop. Of course, you can remove it. I'm not saying that you can't remove it. But the fact is that they are using it as an advertising method, and it's not targeted. It's for everyone. So a possible thing that we can, they can do to focus a little bit more is to have some sort of enterprise desktop, consumer desktop with two different brandings. Because this way the message will be much more clear. If you look at the installation process, for example, you see everything that is related to the consumer and nothing to the enterprise. Well, Ubuntu is an excellent example of reusing lots of different models. They reused the Open Inside model because they took off from Debian and adopted, let's say, a different development strategy from Debian to create releases that are based on their own calendar. It's a very effective model. It would have been probably impossible to start from scratch a new distribution nowadays. I hope that Mr. Assad, which is the new president, will bring it to the level of Red Hat even more. Any other question? Well, there was one alive here, so I'm happy. Good. Thank you very much.